So we're coming back to the Ten Commandments this morning, and we're at number 7. And that seventh commandment is, of course, found in Exodus chapter 20 and verse 14. And it states quite simply, you shall not commit adultery. Now, there is something about this particular commandment that immediately makes us jump to conclusions. I think it has something to do with the fact that it is a commandment so easily and so readily broken by many supposedly law-abiding citizens. If you stop a moment and you look at the first 5 commandments, you will see that they can be broken simply by being negative and ignoring them. You just don't do them. But when it comes to the next 5 commandments, the second 5 commandments, there needs to be a far more positive approach if we are to break them. We have in the 6th commandment to take the positive step of going out and murdering someone in order to break it. Although, as we saw, there are other ways of murdering people than simply taking their life. But even so, you have to do something positive to break it. Whereas in the first 5, you simply don't do them. But if we went out and we murdered someone, literally murdered them, took their life, I'm sure we would find that society as a whole would be against us. Now, the same positive step is required to break the 7th commandment. But in this case, would society in general be against us? Would society in general condemn us? Society has its own view of the commandments, doesn't it? And whereas it sees murder as definitely wrong, it sees adultery, I'm sure, as something that, while not necessarily right, is not altogether wrong. And the problem is that the church and the Christian are more likely to go along with society's view than with God's. And we mustn't allow this to happen. Society says adultery's okay. All right, people have got hurt. But, you know, it's just one of those things. It happens. And we just go along with it. But we mustn't allow this to happen, must we? We as Christians must know, we must understand what God requires, what God expects of us. But you know, we may think that the problem of adultery is something new to our generation, but it's not. It has been there through the ages. It was a problem in the Old Testament, wasn't it? It was a problem in the Old Testament such as that stoning was there for adulterers. It was a problem in the New Testament. And we can see that with the woman caught in adultery. The woman who'd had 7 husbands, both of which are there in the New Testament, adultery. And it's been a problem ever since throughout history. Thomas Watson, the 17th century Puritan preacher, writes in his book, The Ten Commandments, "It is a matter for lamentation to see this commandment so slighted and violated among us. Adultery is the reigning sin of the times." Well, if it was a reigning sin of the 17th century, It's surely one of the reigning sins of this time. It's rampant, isn't it? It's rampant, certainly, in this country. You can go into the website to on Google, and you can Google adultery. You can Google thou shalt not commit adultery. And you will find loads and loads of people who are talking about thou shalt not commit adultery. And at the bottom of the page, there's how you can commit adultery. There's an encouragement to commit adultery. That's the sort of age that we are living in. And so it is one of the reigning sins of this time. But sadly, there are not many preachers today prepared to speak out against it. And we need somehow, if it's indeed at all possible, to stem the tide of this thing that is having such a devastating effect on our nation, a devastating effect on our families, on men and on women, and of children from broken homes. It's devastating. We might take it for granted, because the world takes it for granted. But when you see what it does, when you hear what it does, when you read what it does, you will understand something of how terrible it is. Well, I went this morning to look at this commandment under three headings. And the first of those headings is this: explaining adultery. I want to try and answer two questions here. The first of which is, why has God given us this commandment? The basic answer is because God wants his institution of marriage to be honoured and not debased. God instituted marriage, didn't he, in the Garden of Eden. We're told in Genesis 2, as I mentioned earlier, that after Adam named the animals, there was still no suitable helper for him. But this was no afterthought. God knew what he was going to do. But God was showing Adam, God was showing us the situation. And so it was then that God made Eve and gave her to Adam. And verse 24 of Genesis 2 says this: "For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and they will become one flesh." That is marriage, isn't it? We might say that, well, that's a bit one-sided. We're talking there about a man leaving his father and his mother. It also works the other way around. A woman leaving her father and mother to be united as man and wife, to become one flesh. That's marriage. Today, even marriage is somewhat debased, isn't it? Because we have so many people living together. In essence, people living together are married. They are one flesh. What they haven't done is gone through a proper marriage ceremony. But in essence, they are married. We know, don't we, that when Jesus came to this earth, he honoured marriage with his presence, John chapter 2 and verse 2. Later, in answer to a problem of immorality in the Corinthian church, Paul wrote to them in 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 2, each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband. Now, I need to say something here, and that is this: that when it says each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband, it's speaking to a particular situation. It's not saying that every man should have a wife. It's not saying that every woman should have a husband. And sometimes We forget that. There are single people. And the Bible recognizes that there are single people. But what it's speaking about here is a man who is married. He has one wife. And we have a woman who is married. She has one husband. His own wife, her own husband. And what God is saying, and what Jesus is saying, and what Paul is saying, and what the whole of the Bible is saying, is that there is something right and proper about marriage. There is something right and proper about sex within marriage. And the writer of the Hebrews confirms this. In chapter 13 and verse 4, he says, marriage should be honored by all, and the marriage bed kept pure, for God will judge the adulterer and all the sexually immoral. So here it is plainly given to us that there is a reason for a man and a woman to leave their families, to come together, to be one, not only in marriage, but also in sexuality and sex as well. But with the mention here of the adulterer, we return to the seventh commandment and to a second question, which is, what is adultery? The key to this question is found in a phrase in the middle of Hebrews 13 and verse 4 that says, the marriage bed should be kept pure. Adultery has to do with marriage. To get it clear in our minds, we need to realize that the Bible uses two words for what we might term illicit sexual relationships. One is translated adultery, and the other is translated fornication. The Greek word for fornication is porneia, and you can understand quite easily that that's the word that where we get our word pornography from. It's used of illicit sexual intercourse. And it can include adultery. The other Greek word used is moikos, which denotes one who has unlawful intercourse with the spouse of another. And this is what the seventh commandment is speaking about. Adultery is where one of the partners of a marriage, or those living together, becomes involved in a sexual relationship with someone else. So this is basically adultery explained. And now we're going to move on to examining adultery. Many people today might ask why, in such an enlightened society, is adultery so wrong? It's going on all the time. So many people do it. So why make such a big deal about it? Well, again, to discover the answer to this, we have not only the Bible to help us, but the evidence of our own eyes. Most of us, I'm sure, know from our own experience, or from television or the newspapers, of marriages where adultery has taken place. And not only have we seen that there has been adultery, but we've seen the resulting traumas. What then does adultery do? It does a number of things, and here are just a few of them. You'll be able to add others. First and foremost, as we've seen, it breaks God's rules, breaks God's commandments. And when we break God's rules, we not only sin against an individual, we sin against him. People don't consider the Ten Commandments and are not aware of the benefit they are for all of us. They fail to see, as we so often do, that this command, like the others, is there for our good, and that we might be in danger if we disobey. These commandments are not there to prevent us from having a good time, as I said earlier. In fact, the opposite is true. They are, in a sense, so that we can have a good time, so that we know where the boundaries are. Remember Joseph. At one point in the life of Joseph, he was put in charge of Potiphar's household. He was in command of everything, control of everything. And you know how the story goes, don't you? Potiphar's wife tried to get Joseph to go to bed with her. But Joseph said, according to Genesis 39 and verse 9, "My master has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How then could I do such a wicked thing and sin against God?" Joseph knew that to have committed adultery with his master's wife would not only have been a sin against him, but more importantly, against God. And think about it a little bit more. Think about what would have happened to Joseph if he had committed adultery. How long would it have been before he was in prison, before he had lost his life? Yes, he was put in prison because he didn't commit adultery. But had he committed adultery with her, then he would certainly have been put in prison for the right reason and probably killed. David too realized this, that adultery was wrong. But he discovered it too late, or almost too late. He committed adultery with Bathsheba. David was married, Bathsheba was married. But he says to God in Psalm 51 and verse 4, "Against you, you only have I sinned and done what is evil in your sight." That wasn't quite true, was it? Yes, it had marred his relationship with God. But it wasn't only against God that he sinned, it was against other people as well. But what we need to realize is that the first thing adultery does is mar our relationship with God. And then, of course, it mars our relationship within the marriage. It mars our relationship with the family. And very often it mars that relationship to such an extent that it destroys them. We all know stories, don't we, of broken marriages resulting from adultery and the heartache that's caused both at the time and subsequently. And this is something we often forget about sin, something that we miss about sin. We miss its effects on others. We sin, but it affects others. Sin has repercussions, and that is certainly so with adultery. Adultery mars marriage, mars families. And as we have seen, it is God's will that a man and a woman should come together to become one. When they do, and only then, should they have a sexual union. And it has to be said that that sexual union has to be worked at. It is in actual fact a consummation of the marriage and something that flows from it. And what else flows from it is the procreation of children. Now, that doesn't always happen, but that's one of the reasons for it. And this is why we say that sex outside of marriage is wrong. But what is equally wrong is the taking of another partner by one of the two married people, for they are breaking a marriage vow. taken in the presence of God, as well as defiling what God has ordained. It mars our relationship to God, to the family, to marriage itself. It also mars true love. I don't mean true love in a sentimental way, in a sentimental sense, but in a real sense. New Testament Greek has three words for love. Ros, from which we get erotic, and which clearly refers to erotic love. Philia, from which we get philanthropy, and which describes the love of kindness and companionship, or tender affection. There are sometimes people who get married for those reasons. But the third one is agape, which you'll know. Describes a love of commitment, an unselfish love, a love that is ready to serve. And it's agape, which is true love, but it is eros, erotic love, which more, and even filio, companionship love, which more often than not results in adultery. Adultery mars our faithfulness also. Our faithfulness to God, our faithfulness to our wife or husband, and our faithfulness to others in the family. Our unfaithfulness in marriage may also be indicative, mightn't it, of unfaithfulness in other areas of our life as well. And finally, let's also notice that adultery can so easily mar our bodies, for it exposes us to both physical and emotional damage. Well, we could say more, but we need to leave it there and turn to my final point, which is excluding adultery. There is no foolproof way of excluding or avoiding adultery. Anyone who thinks there is needs to take care lest they be caught off their guard. The Old Testament stories of Joseph and David clearly illustrate this, don't they? If anyone ever had good reason not to commit adultery, it was Joseph. But even he came so close to it. And you could so easily have thought Joseph might say to himself, well, you know, unless I do this, I'm in real trouble. And so he may have taken what we would consider the easy way out and have committed adultery to get himself out of a sticky problem. And David, there he was, up on his rooftop, looking down, and there was Bathsheba, and he saw Bathsheba, and he liked what he saw, and he went out and got it. It's so easy to do. So what can we do to try and exclude or avoid it? Well, we can remember firstly that it's not just the outward act of adultery that is sin. This is what we've discovered on others of the commandments, isn't it? We look at the commandment and we say, adultery is that. But we need to look at what we've termed the family of the commandment. We saw in murder that the religious leaders placed so much emphasis on the outward act that they failed to warn of the inward sin. So we begin to despise a person. We begin to hate a person. And that is what leads to sin. And it's the same with adultery. Because outward acts come from the heart within. This is what Jesus was saying in Matthew 5 and verse 28. But I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. It wasn't David's sight of Bathsheba or Potiphar's wives of Joseph that was wrong, but the lustful thoughts that went with it. There is nothing wrong, in essence, with a boy or a man looking at a girl, a woman, or vice versa. But we need to realize that when such looks turn to lustful thought, then it's clearly and unequivocally wrong. It is sin. Such lustful thoughts, given half an opportunity, will lead to adultery, as with David, and so nearly with Joseph. But there's a question here, and it's this. What is the difference between adultery in thought and in deed? If both doing it and thinking it are sin, why shouldn't I just do it? That's preposterous. That's ridiculous. But I was actually asked that question. Somebody once asked me that question. If I'm thinking about doing it, isn't that the same as doing it? So why shouldn't I just do it? Well, look again at David and Potiphar's wife. There was first a sin of thought. For David, that sin of thought was compounded not only by his sin of action, but by his leading Bathsheba into sin as well. If David had said, "No, I mustn't look at her in that way," it would not have led to his sin, it would not have led to Bathsheba's sin. With Potiphar's wife, her sin of thought was not compounded by the act of adultery, only because Joseph refused to sleep with her. If he'd said yes, then he would have sinned, as well as her sinning. So the sin of the thought is in one person's mind, but the moment that thought develops, there is sin in the other person as well. Well, in order to exclude adultery, we must see the thought of it as well as the action of it as sin. We must also realize that sex within marriage is the God-given order of things. Then and only then will there be a really lasting and satisfying sex, a sex between husband and wife. It may be possible to have what we might call erotic or companionship sex outside marriage. But at the end of the day, will it be either lasting or truly satisfying? The answer is no. It's the agape sex within marriage that we ought to be looking for. That, of course, demands responsibility from both partners, doesn't it? But once we get our thinking right on these two matters, we need to get our actions right as well. And this means being careful in the choice of various things. It means being careful in the choice of the places we go. There are places we don't go because we know what will happen if we go there. We need to be careful with the people we mix with. We need to be careful of the conversations we have with people, the programs we watch on our television, the videos and films and CDs that we watch, the books, the magazines, the newspapers that we read, the sites we visit on our computers, the clothes we wear, so many things that are involved in this matter of not committing adultery. We need to be aware of the things that are likely to lead us into this problem. Well, these are some of the things that will not only help us exclude adultery, but will also enable us, hopefully, to exclude fornication as well. And we must be positive. We must be positive. For many marriages fail because people are not prepared to work at them, to talk them through. We must realise that marriage is God-given and seek positively to discover the joys that God has for us in it. Our choices too must be positive and not simply negative. We must look for choices that will enhance a positive approach to our attitude towards holiness, toward faithfulness, and towards marriage. So, explaining adultery, it's sex by one partner of a marriage outside of the marriage. It's allied to, though not totally equivalent, to fornication. Examining adultery mars, amongst other things, our relationship to God, to the family, and to marriage itself. Excluding adultery, we need to see it as sin, to see marriage in its God-given beauty, and to be careful of our actions. Well, I've spoken only of physical adultery, but it should be also noted, as we saw with murder, that there is a family of adultery. A family of sin flowing from adultery, as there is from murder. Very often in the scriptures, our relationship to God is likened to that of a husband and wife. And it's possible for us to be guilty of spiritual adultery as well as physical adultery. I sometimes think that adultery is a bit like an idolatry. When we're looking at idolatry, it's anything that takes us away from God. And in a sense, adultery is anything that takes us away from our partner in marriage. Let me leave you with a definition of adultery from Dr. Peter Masters, pastor of the Metropolitan Tabernacle. He says, "The use of the term adultery in the Bible shows that it is the chief of a family of sins, which may be broadly described in this way. Sins which involve a betrayal of, or disloyalty to, any special bond or relationship to which we have a scriptural duty of faithfulness, including our relationship with the Lord." Let the question be this morning, not how is your adultery, but how is your faithfulness? How is my faithfulness in all things? And sing as we conclude. "You, O Lord, have searched and known me. You know when I sit or rise. Every thought and deed lies open to your all-perceiving eyes."